Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to take a look at the world of insects with our guest entomologist Phil Pelletieri back with us. Phil's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. So as we talk with Phil, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have? There's some bugs that are bugging you or want to talk about maybe saving the bugs? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Let's talk about ants to begin the show. I've got a few of them I've noticed roaming around my home. And I think this time of the year, they often find their way into homes, various common species.
You know, in most of it's all about food. You know, you see ants in the winter, you know they're nesting indoors. Typically, if ants don't show up until the spring and summer, it's more likely the nests are outside and they're foraging. And, of course, the kitchen's a big place. But even the bathroom, my toothpaste and whatnot, has some substances that could get certain ants interested. So, you know, the easy thing for an entomologist to say is you find the nest, treat it so you're killing the queen, who is basically responsible for all the ants you see. But that is much easier said than done. And so, you know, the trick that we try to use is to bait them. And the big trick with baiting is you have to figure out what your ants like. Either they have a sweet tooth, they're more likely into proteins and fats, and some ants take both. And if you can find a bait that they accept, you keep feeding it with the idea that they will take it back to the queen, and that's how you wipe the colony out. So it takes a little patience, but honestly, it often is more effective than many of the sprays we use repel them. So you stop seeing them for a while, but you really don't control them.
Yeah, so what are the types of ants? The odorous house ants? They're the sugary ones, aren't they?
Yeah, honestly, they showed up in the Pelletieri household this spring. And I used some baits that I can even get at the grocery store that have boric acid as the toxicant, but they're sweet baits. And it was interesting. From the time I put it out, within a half an hour, there was 40 to 50 ants around the baits. They were very active for a day, and then nothing, absolutely nothing. Now, I'm not sure I wiped them out. The problem with odorous house ants, they can have multiple queens and multiple nest sites, and so it gets a little more complicated. But it had the effect of stopping from seeing ants, and we're 2 weeks after that effect, and I haven't seen one since.
Carpenter ants, I think I had one roaming in the house.
Yeah, I don't get too nervous about just those foragers. And again, typically if there's a pattern in the kitchen, you start to wonder what kind of spillage or things I can clean up. Because, again, ants have a way of communicating to their nest mates that there's a food source. They even have chemical odor trails that they use to come back and forth. And, you know, if carpenter ants are nesting in the house, you see them in the winter, or you see their wing forms, which we call swarmers. All of a sudden, you know, there's 50 winged ants up in the corner of the ceiling. Anytime you see winged ants in the house, you know they're nesting indoors. But these individual workers, they're just looking for food, and again, nothing to get too excited about. And if you get a pattern, then you start to trace it back. And we've talked about on the show before, if you're willing to put the time in, you can even physically put food out for them on purpose. And then at night, because they're more active at night, go out with a flashlight and trail them and see if the trail goes up into your attic. Well, okay, you know, you have a nest in the house. If they go out into the backyard, you can even go as far as finding what tree. But I warn you, it could be 50 to 70 yards away.
You know, I saw the coolest story in the Washington Post. Scientists have discovered that Florida carpenter ants will amputate the injured limbs of fellow ants to save their lives, and they had some video of it. That's remarkable.
Well, in particular, because it depends what part of the leg is injured, whether they'll go through the process or not. In the scheme of things, they're probably higher level ants than carpenter ants, but I've always been duly impressed You know, one of the things when we started getting into baiting, we found out about them is that they were not foolish enough, if you gave them a bait, to give the bait to the queen right away. Again, because she's so valuable. The old, you know, king had food tasters back in the day. Well, this is what the ants have already evolved to. And so, yeah, I'm never totally surprised when we stumble across some new fascinating thing that ant behavior, ant chemistry and whatnot. They're just really very fascinating creatures.
They are indeed. Suzanne in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. I have a story about a staghorn beetle. I was cleaning out a brush pile that I had cut. I was barefoot on the side of my garage, and I felt this pinch, and I looked down, and this 2-inch long, just the body was 2 inches long. This thing was clamped onto the side of my foot, and I was a little bit upset and scared, and I thought it was a June bug, but I had to bang my foot against the fence for the thing to finally let go. And it was a really big staghorn beetle, and nothing really happened to me. And I took some pictures of it, and then I found out that they eat the wood. But I was wondering about that. I've seen other people posting pictures of staghorn beetles this year. I just wondered, are there a whole bunch more of them around this year?
Hmm. No, you know, I tend to would see them come in the lab every year to one degree or another. You know, a lot of what goes on is the adults are attracted to lights, and so they would be coming into yard lights and whatnot, and then you find them around that area the next morning. When we find the grubs, it's usually in rotting stumps and the like, and they're great big grubs, and they are related distantly, but not really that far of a distance, to June beetles. And, you know, the females typically have smaller pincers. It's not their normal behavior to bite, but if you put things in front of their jaws, they will clinch. And they have little, they're not fangs, but little thorns or bumps, you know, so it gives you the impression that they're really mean. And in fact, they use that to their benefit, I think, to scare things away. What's really interesting when you look on a worldwide basis, the ones we have in Wisconsin, although are impressive, are really quite small compared to some of the ones in the tropics, which are just, you know, four inches plus long, and again with a great big pair of jaws. And typically it's the males with the big jaws, the females with somewhat lesser jaws for a given species.
Thank you very much for calling, Suzanne. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's talk about Japanese beetles for a minute. This is kind of a prime season for Japanese beetles to feed on, a lot of garden plants and so forth. Where in the state are Japanese beetles found these days?
Honestly, up where you are right now, in fact, I talked to PJ, who, you know, PJ has been running the lab since I left. And, you know, he said basically everything is middle of state north as far as the big numbers. And, you know, we've talked about this on the show. You know, things went downhill very quickly around the year 2000 in the Madison area. And there were a couple summers that there was not a birch tree in my neighborhood that had a leaf on it or a linden tree. I mean, technically, there's 300 species of plants plus that these things feed on. I never saw a yellow flower on my potentilla bushes. There were so many of them, they would just eat them off. And typically, things start about the end of June. And so right now, it should be crazy in my neighborhood. Now, again, I'm 25 years past when they showed up. I have seen two total in my yard.
Wow.
And that seems to be the pattern, that generally in the southern part of the state, where they have been established longer, the numbers go down. But areas that they move into, it goes from a trickle to an absolute, well, I tease people, like a science fiction movie, because they're just where. And biologically, they are so frustrating, because aside from the wide variety of plants they feed on, most of the ones that are feeding in your yard don't breed in your yard. They're coming from down the road. So you don't even have control over where they come from. Their grubs feed on grasses, so they technically should be a lawn pest. But even in all those crazy times that I've had, I never saw enough grubs in my lawn to cause damage. And now I live a couple blocks from a golf course, so I have a real strong suspicion where most of the ones came from. And one of my colleagues back in the day when things were getting out of hand, I mean, he could find as many as 40 per square foot in the right place. And so if you think about those and then that they can migrate a half a mile or more, you can see the frustration people have. And then this feeding pattern goes on for 4 to 6 weeks. So, you know, fine, there's things you can spray, but all it does is knock things down for about a week. And there just is no easy way to shut off this incursion when they come in. I mean, you can change what plants you grow, but, you know, that's, again, a long-term commitment. But the good news I give people, as I said, it's been my experience, is it may be nasty for a few years, but then it typically evolves like it has here. And what has happened is we've got some natural diseases that are killing the grubs off and other things. And honestly, I think the drought that we had in the southern part of the state didn't do them any good either last year. It will be interesting to see if they get a resurgence next year because we're on the exact opposite, the lushness that we have because of the rain.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, and I should have mentioned that I'm broadcasting today from our WPNE studios in Green Bay. Yesterday I was in Sister Bay, and I want a big thanks just on the side to the audience, that live audience, folks that came to watch the show. It was really a lot of fun, and now I'm having some fun with Karina here in WPNE in Green Bay. Well, Mary in Ashapan, it's your turn. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm having a problem with earwigs. They seem to be in my house this year. I mean, I can find them by the kitchen sink area and then the bathrooms, too.
Yep. So the good news is they're not breeding in your house. The bad news is they're invading from outside, and earwigs love it lush. And, again, it's been so lush. And so they do most of their feeding at night, which causes quite a bit of problems on some of our garden plants. And then the next day you come out there and you don't even see them, so people often don't put those two parts together. But when the sun comes up, they're scurrying and looking places that are damp and dark. And if they can work up underneath your siding or come in through pipe chases or other things, now they have access to your walls. And all of a sudden, again, when they're out looking for things to do at night, they'll show up typically where water is, but not all the way. So usually what we suggest is don't bother spraying into the side. Again, they're not breeding there, I can assure it. One of the things, though, is, you know, if it's one particular side of the house that you have most of the problems, you start inspecting. And I would tell you that the weakness of most of our constructions in Wisconsin is where the siding meets the foundation. There's often a spacing. And something like an earwig can crawl up in there and then have access to the house. So if you can solve the riddle of how they're getting in and physically stop it, you will not have earwig problems down the road. But if that isn't possible, if you were to spray, you spray outside along the foundation and in the mulch areas and the places that are damp and where they hide. Honestly, the same thing goes to me in garden plants. There's no reason to treat the plant because they're not spending their time there. They're hiding down in the mulch during the day. So you treat the mulch areas and kind of soak things in to help knock them down. Now, good news, there's only one generation a year. Very interesting insects because they overwinter as adults in the ground, and the females raise their young for the first few weeks, and they don't come out of the ground typically till the end of May as half-grown earwigs, and then the assault starts. So we're getting into the latter part, so the numbers should start to lessen to some degree. But when a year is this lush, again, I'm not surprised, and again, PJ had shared with me a large number of complaints. I've gotten calls from one of my nieces who, again, she's in the Milwaukee area, and they just overtook all her plants outdoors. Drier weather would help. You know, in years that are not quite as wet, it's still a problem in the gardens because we water our gardens, you know, and so again, we create environments that earwigs like. But this has to be the worst year I have seen in the last at least 7 or 8. And again, considering the rainfall patterns, it doesn't surprise me.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We'll be talking to a researcher about how wolves, foxes, and martens are competing for resources on Lake Superior's Isle Royal at 12:30 today. So looking forward to that. And looking forward to the rest of my conversation with Phil Pelletieri, and I hope you are as well. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jonathan in Madison. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. This question pertains to fire ants. I came from down south, and I've been up here 8 years. First of all, I'm going to say you have a beautiful state when it blooms. I want to ask you, down south, I've I'm definitely allergic to fire ants. Okay. I told my mother down in Texas that I traded the cold for the fire ants. I want to know how much of a, because the cold has kept them in a certain part of the United States. How much of an invasive threat are they to this area of the country?
Okay.
We're far enough north, honestly, that it I'm not going to say never, because one of my favorite lines with, you know, when I started my career and watched what happened is that the governor moved the state to Missouri without telling us. So we are definitely seeing a lot of influx, but you kind of see Tennessee as a line right now. And so we've got quite a bit of buffer. And, you know, we have occasionally seen fire ants coming in on potting plants in greenhouses and atriums and the like, but there has never been, and I'm sure they have been brought in numerous times, evidence of them establishing outdoors. And so I think we're there. Now, we don't really have much in the way of stinging ants of importance in the state. We do have some ants that like to bite, so I'm not going to say that ants don't, but nothing like fire ants up here. And as I said, I know in my lifetime, and I don't even think my grandkids' lifetime, we're going to see them move this far north.
So you're safe here, Jonathan. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Don in Iron River, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Don.
Hello. Say, every summer I've got infestations of these little teeny, teeny, tiny ants. They scurry around. They're kind of like copper brown colored, and they're about the size of a pencil chip.
Okay. You know, it could be a couple, but again, we had talked earlier that odorous house ant is a common, very small ant that comes in. And again, if you watched it, it seems to have more of a sweet tooth. You know, so if you spilled juices or whatnot, those kind of things would get them quite interested. And again, because the nests are outdoors, you're experiencing this phenomena of them invading, looking for food. And, you know, some ants like this can have temporary nests where they move into a site, especially for the summer, and then they move back out into the ground in the winter. You know, the two options is, one, when they show up, bait them, and again, try to match the bait. And this one, I would, if you're ever in question, you just put a little honey out in a piece of wax paper and you put a little bit of cooking oil and see which of the two they want. So then you can go to the store and buy, and there are numerous baits that are out there. And if you match the bait, the only mistake you can make is not giving them as much bait as they need. So you just keep the bait out, you know, until all of a sudden you don't see ants. And I would even keep it out for a few days afterwards just to be sure, with the whole idea that they will take it back out to wherever those hidden nests are and take care of the queens. And now, could you totally eliminate them from your yard? I bet you not, because I think that there, you know, there's other places that they can go. They don't have to come in for food. The other option, whether you do this yourself or you hire a professional pest control company, is there are sprays that can be sprayed on the outside of the house that will help control the ants. And depending on which they choose, it may repel the ants and keep them out for weeks. Or there are some products, honestly, that don't repel them that will kill them given enough time. So when things just really get out of hand, that's the option. But I think the thing to keep in mind is, I don't see gaining much by spraying indoors unless if all the ants disappeared in a particular windowsill in a little hole, which would make me suspicious that there's a nest in there. To put a spray nozzle in there and spray, I think, is a valid experiment to see if it works. But again, as far as nuisance ants, either you head them off outside along the foundation or you bait them is the way to go.
And Don, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Shelby, we'll go to you in Ellsworth. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a farm, and this year the mosquitoes have been really bad because of all the rain we've got. I'm just wondering if you have any recommendations for mosquito and gnat control for like a wider farm space. From the horse side of things, they all have fly gear on and all the protective stuff. I use fly spray that covers mosquitoes and that. And then I'm vaccinating for like West Nile, kind of an extra booster throughout the year. But just wondering for keeping them comfortable and getting bit less, how we can reduce our exposure.
Sure. It's a tough one. I mean, honestly, other than fans and other things, it will generate enough wind speed to keep, you know, and have the animals close by. you know, the impossible problem is there are sprays that can be put down, but they only last for a few number of days. And the mosquitoes aren't breeding where the animals are. They're coming, to be honest, could be from 10 to 15 miles down the road. Now, keeping unneeded vegetation down, you know, keeping things mowed and whatnot helps a bit because there's just less places for the mosquitoes to hide during the day. But that's all kind of relative. And then, again, once you get to that low wind, low light, dusk area when the mosquitoes become quite active, it's just clouds of them migrating in. And again, it gets very frustrating because there are really no easy answers when it gets this wet. In considering, again, of the 54, 56 kind of mosquitoes we got, the ones that will give us the biggest nuisance problem are these summer floodwater mosquitoes that take advantage of all this puddled water that's sitting out there. And, you know, it just is about the time you think it's getting better, then we get another 3-incher and we're right back and didn't start the next generation.
Shelby, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Christina emailed us, Phil, and I don't know if you've had a chance to see the photo of a small beetle they are seeing on lots of trees and various plants. Can you identify it and say whether they do any damage?
Okay, I'm calling it up, and once in a while my computer gets a little grumpy, so I can't see the pictures yet, but we'll try it again. Okay, let me just shut this down and
try it again. Okay. While you're working
now,
on
it. It's interesting, you know,
yeah,
the point about various different plants. That's not a normal insect behavior. You know, most insects are really quite specific to what they get. You know, in my first thought of a general critter always is Japanese beetle. But quarter inch, they're bigger than that. Nope. Lo and behold, it is Japanese beetle.
Oh, it is.
Oh, I'm sorry at that diagnosis. Only again, because they're not breeding on her property. They're flying in, and they're numerous, including organic sprays that you can use to protect your plants. But at best, it's a week, and as we had talked about earlier, this can be as long as a 5 to 6 week onslaught. So you get into rather high maintenance. Now, a story I tell about my experience, I mentioned earlier how about I had a potentilla that they just would get in. You find that they gang up on certain plants. And if you can stop them from doing that early, they'll find some other plant to gang up on. And unfortunately, it was my neighbor's Gattoni aster hedge, but it wasn't my plant. And it was interesting just to watch that. If I got out very early and kept that first wave off, it honestly made quite a bit of difference. Now, the good news in as far as the plants are concerned is most of this damage is cosmetic. I mean, you know, we're not talking life or death for the plants in most cases, but they pick on things like basil and other things that, honestly, we'd rather not spray and the like. So, you know, people go to netting and other ways of trying to physically keep them off, some of the herbs and the like. And as I said, I hate to see people given the misinformation that if they put various things on their lawn, they'll go away and solve it. Because, as I said, my experience is that has very little to do with what's going on in your lawn. They're coming in from down the road. And generally, the more areas that you have lush, grassy stuff is the kind of habitat they do very well in.
We will take another call here. Let's go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I live in the city of Kenosha, and there's a prairie near to me. And once a month, I feed the songbirds, and the mosquitoes have been down.
Have been down? Do you mean there's very few?
That eat mosquitoes.
Oh, you haven't seen many birds?
No, mosquitoes. They eat the mosquitoes.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. You've kept the mosquito population down with the birds, you think. Okay. What do you think, Phil?
Well, they do, although, you know, I like to give credit to my friends, the dragonflies, as being even better mosquito feeders, just because they concentrate on small gnats. And some birds do, you know, purple martins and whatnot feed on some of that small stuff. But birds often prefer a bigger meal and the like. And so there could be some other dynamics going on there. There are other predators involved. In general, again, this has been old-fashioned, this is what mosquitoes are like in this state when it's wet. As I said, it's been to the point that it affects people's outdoors activity. I know that, and as I said, it's kind of what I expected from this. So it is interesting. You're blessed to be in enough of an area. And again, birds definitely help, but there are definitely some more important predators for mosquitoes. As in, you know, you point to temporary water as the biggest problem for these floodwater mosquitoes. We find that 95% of the mosquitoes come from 5% of the available water. And it's not the lakes and ponds where you've got frogs and fish and all kinds of aquatic insects that will feed on them. Where we get more trouble is you know, highway drainage ditches and whatnot that are temporary because there's no predators there to begin with, you know. And the way the floodwater mosquitoes work is they lay their eggs on the edges of this temporary water, and if it dries, they're like little time bombs. And if it takes 3 years before it floods, they're fine with that. So they're always waning. And the higher that you put the water level, you can argue the more eggs that you're flooding and the more that you see. And so, as I said, we do see this pattern. In last year, when it was incredibly dry, there was not this temporary water, and it was you could go out at any time and really not have much of a problem. And it takes time to settle down. I mean, I normally figure at least 3 weeks after a flooding rain. Now, you will hear us talk about, you know, being careful around your house. It's true that bird baths and other things can breed mosquitoes. That's typically not the mosquitoes that are giving us the nuisance here. Honestly, the bigger concern is a lot of the disease vectoring mosquitoes are ones that breed in these temporary water containers. So it's good to make sure that water does not pool for more than 8 to 10 days as best you can. But again, the problem, like the Japanese beetle, you cannot point to your yard as being a breeding site in most cases. They are blowing in from down the road, and we have definitely documented them coming from 10, 15, 20 miles away. And once they blow in, they stick where it's highly humid and shady and whatnot. So that's where the vegetation comes in. And then when things quiet down and the wind allows them to fly, that's when they come up. And, you know, again, you're golfing and you hit in the rough and you get in the long grass, and all of a sudden it's like clouds coming out of it.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest. Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota, will go to you. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. I have lived with deer flies for almost 50 years down here, and they are so awful. I'd like to know more about them. Is there anything, you know, when you're out in the country, they don't spray for anything, and how do you deal with these darn things?
Yeah, so what goes on with deer flies and horse flies is they tend to breed, again, where there's water, but typically it's the edge of ponds and swamps. Their maggots are predators in the soil, and so they go about and eat other critters. But then when the adults come out, being as strong flyers as they are, they come in and patrol areas, and they are attracted to moving things. And so, you know, when you go out there, you'll see sometimes people would tell me, you know, that they'd have some land, and they'd go to the land, and they'd drive the car, you know, back on the little trail, and all of a sudden they get out of the car, and there was literally a flock of deer flies that it was attracted to the moving car, and that's kind of typical. So it's not like you can spray anything per se. I mean, there are some things. There was a type of deer fly trap you could put on your hat. It's basically just a sticky card, and so when they would land on that sticky card, they would get caught. That helps a little. You know, it doesn't solve everything. They're also, and I don't know if this is still on the market, way back, USDA put out a horse and deer fly trap. And honestly, it's a big dark ball hanging from a tripod. And when the ball moves in the wind, they're attracted to it. And then they have a funnel up on the top. And so the horse and deer flies would be attracted up into that area. And you put the trap out in the open. You don't put it in the middle of the woods because that's not really where the problem is. It's on these edges that the deer flies control. And it's interesting. People that had it.
They liked usually, it.
Yeah, they would catch enough that they said, you know, their horses had a lot of relief. Now, the old version was the horse pal horse fly trap. I don't know if it's still on the market or not, or are there similar things. But there definitely is some science to how those work. And as I said, it was an old USDA experiment. It takes time to trap them out, though. And, you know, again, if you've got 50 acres, I don't know, think it's practical to put, you know, buy six traps or whatever. But as I said, it's just the nature of the critter. It's not like you can spray something because they don't rest anywhere. I mean, if they had that biological weakness of resting on a site, you could put something to help knock them down, but they don't. They just kind of patrol back and forth, and again, the more you move, the more they're excited to chase you.
Okay. Let's take another call. Rick in Door County. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We've got some ash trees, and there's a lot of them that have deceased, but we've got some that are important to us, and we have the arborists come in and treat them. And we've got an alternate year plan going on. This year, when they treated, about 2 weeks later, the emerald ash borers on the sidewalk, my wife is sweeping them up every day, and I assume they're in the grassy areas too, but just 100 of them. What should we make of that?
Well, you know, part of what happens is the adult beetles feed on leaves. And so, in fact, you know, if you're watching for them, you see these little notches in the leaves. They're not very big. So I think what's going on is they're attracted to your trees, and as they're feeding on the leaves, they're picking up some of the insecticide that the arborists put in there, and that's why you're killing them, which also argues that the sheer numbers of emerald ash borers in your neighborhood. It's quite unusual to see them rain like that, but that tells me that there's an awful lot of them around.
There you go. Thank you so much for that question. Appreciate your call. We had another email from Joe in Medford. Have you noticed black ash trees in poorly drained soils exhibiting a crown dieback? He says the trees with this have new growth flushing along the main pole. He's in the northern part of the state where ash tree, the ash borer is just getting started. But these trees don't have evidence of ash borer. I've heard of cottony psyllid invasive species.
Boy, you know, it's tough because that is kind of classic ash borer activity, where you see trees where the crowns die and you get a lot of flush of growth because they kind of attack top down. And but that being said, you know, there are diseases. What caught us by a little surprise in Michigan, where ash borer first came in, is ashes that had crown dieback could have other problems. There are some vascular diseases and the like, and so, you know, the first people thought, oh, that's just got, you know, verticillium wilt or something like that, not realizing that there was an insect there. The only way you could really verify it is to get in there and peel back some bark to see if you saw any ash borer larvae. So as I said, it makes me concerned. More typically with the diseases, the whole plant kind of goes down. It isn't that used to get as much suckering. And as I said, that's why I am concerned that it is ash borer. But so some, the vascular diseases in particular are the ones that can cause some of those problems.
Allison in La Crosse emailed a photo of her hollyhocks. Allison wants to know what causes the holes in the leaves.
Yeah, you know, typically when you see that, you worry about little beetles, little various leaf beetles, and hollyhock does have a couple, three critters that breed on it. But one picture in particular that she sent of just a leaf has an awful lot of orange spots. And honestly, I think the hollyhock has a rust disease, which is causing a lot of the plant dieback and the like. It's a rather common problem on hollyhock. And again, the characteristic of this rust disease is the orange. And even if you rub against it, you almost get an orange dust-like off the plant, and that's part of it. And so, as I said, I wonder if all the collapse she's seeing is disease-related.
Got it. Glenn and Randolph, let's go to you now. Hi, Glenn. Thank you for calling.
Well, first of all, I do not have a photo of the bug. I sent a description to your friends in Madison, and they've never heard of it. I've looked through every bug book or on the internet, and what this is it's a small reddish brown long bug that's maybe not quite a half inch. I don't see any legs on the bottom, but when it either bites or it excretes something, I get about a good quarter inch in diameter festering sore for about a month.
Hmm.
Wow. You know, the critter with not seeing much legs, and in there are some insects that will literally defecate on themselves, and they get this kind of shiny, sticky stuff. But I don't know if any of that, honestly, it typically causes problems. And again, when we go back to insects, you know, blister beetles are a type of insect that they're deceptive because they're soft-winged. They're not crunchy like normal beetles. And the name blister beetle comes from the fact that if you crush them, certain people, individuals, you will get a blister-like reaction and the like. It's not a bite, per se. But the blister beetles should look like an insect. It's got legs, it's got antennae and whatnot. And so it doesn't fit that pattern. So I'm stumped, too. It just doesn't fit. You know, it's got some of the characteristics of some things, but not enough to say, yeah, it's got to be such and such a critter. So, boy, if you ever get a chance to get a picture of it again, I think that's our best shot at giving you a better answer.
Glenn, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Politeri, entomologist with us to talk about summer bug problems inside and outside the house. If you want some help, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You can join us tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show when we talk vehicle maintenance with Jim Ward, a retired service manager at Smart Motors Toyota. It'll be great to talk, have a chance to talk with him tomorrow on the show. Right now, though, we're looking at the world of insects with Phil Politeri. You have a question about a bug that maybe you're just curious about, or maybe it's something that's been bothering you a bit? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Phil, you mentioned spongy moths a little bit earlier on the show, and there were some, I guess, scattered reports of a spongy moth caterpillar die-off in Wisconsin. Did that die-off continue and save a lot of trees from being defoliated?
As far as I can tell, because I have not heard any of the contrary stories of whole forested situations where the trees got totally stripped. You know, so, you know, we know this pattern of dry springs prevents the diseases from controlling them. And so when things got very wet this year, I was very optimistic. And at least my traveling around Madison, which was getting some hot spots, kind of localized, but still some hot spots, I have not seen. I have not seen a caterpillar. And, you know, it would definitely fit the pattern. And as I said, I have yet to see reports. Because, you know, last year was close to the record as far as the number of acres defoliated statewide. And without hearing those things, and we'd see that by now because we're in that point where the adult moths are coming out now and laying the eggs that will get us the next thing. So if there were very large numbers, we would have seen the defoliation a good 2-3 weeks ago, and we're just I just not hearing about it.
Susan in Vilas County has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Susan.
Greetings. Hi, Phil. I am calling because I picked up rose slugs this summer. I think they hitched a ride on a shrub service berry that I planted. And I have other plants that I'm afraid it might be friendly to. I'd like to know how to mitigate that before it spreads. And the kicker is I also keep bees. So I want to make sure that I'm putting on something that's not killing my livestock. Yeah.
So is it just the service berry that was showing any problems?
Right now it's just the service berry, and it started manifesting within a week and a half of my bringing it home.
Okay, so what I'm suspicious of is there is not a true slug. They look like slugs, but they're not. But they're a type of sawfly, which is caterpillar-like creature. It doesn't turn into a moth. It turns into something else. But like we were talking about earlier, when the gentleman was having the irritation problem, there are insects that will throw their waste on the back, so they're shiny little devils. And on service berry, they take the surface off the leaf, and then, of course, it browns and dies. And so it's really quite dramatic going on the plant. You could try some soapy water sprays. The other thing, at this time of the year, you know, there really isn't a lot of reason why bees would be on the service berry. So I think there's some organic products like the spinosad products, Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew, and there are some other ones out there that are made for killing caterpillars. And by general, they're not overly toxic to bees. But in particular, you know, you never would want to spray a plant that was blooming anyway, because whatever you're putting it on it is putting the bees at risk. But we're at the point now that, as I said, the bees really should not have much interest. And as long as the hive is not underneath the service berry bush, I don't think it's going to be a problem. But the other good news about that is it's host specific. So you're not going to see this spread to other plants that you got in the garden, because that's all they eat is service berry. But as I said, I'm wondering if you've got one of these little slug larvae that's on there. And there are some true caterpillars that do the same thing, but by nature it's usually leaf beetles. And again, there are a few sawflies that go through this kind of slimy, immature stage. And of course, the reason they do that is for their own defense.
There you go, Susan. Thank you so much for calling. Let's take another call. Stephanie in Anagol, your turn. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. You were just talking about spongy moss. I'm just tuning in, forgive me. But I've noticed that the caterpillars will go up the tree, and they'll eat and eat and eat and get real big and fat, and they come back down to the trunk of the tree, and they just die. They sit there, and they rest, and they die.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on, and what's the larvae cycle? Did they reproduce up in the tree? How do they lay eggs?
Sure. Are they
coming back, or what's going on?
Yeah, so you're witnessing either a virus die-off, which is a disease, or this fungal disease that goes after them. So that's absolutely classic. You see dead caterpillars hanging, and depending if they are V-shaped, or they're just hanging from, you know, top to bottom, helps you distinguish, but that's not important. What they transform into is a moth. The female is white with a little bit of black striping in it. The male is a little bit more of a yellowish color. And the females are flightless. And so they literally have to crawl and lay these egg masses that are about the size of a quarter. Again, are light tan and fuzzy in appearance, and usually those are on the trunks, the trees, but you can see them on fence posts in the side of your house. I mean, they kind of put them all over the place. And that's how the critter will get from the end of summer through the fall, winter, and then hatch again next spring when the trees start to leaf out. So one way you can assess what kind of populations you got is if you see a bunch of egg masses there, you know that they had a very good year, and we're going to have problems the next spring. I'm guessing you're not going to see much because, as I said, you're seeing one of these natural die-offs, which is what we were all hoping for. If you see a lot of egg masses, they can be scraped. They can be sprayed with soybean oil. There are ways of getting them. One of the other tricks that people use sometimes is they put a burlap band. They tie a rope and put a burlap bag around it, and when the caterpillars come down, they hide underneath that. And so then people would collect them. But I don't think you need to do that because, as I said, what you are witnessing is the natural die-off we get when we get the right weather conditions.
There you go, Stephanie. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Linda in Eau Claire. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Larry and Phil.
Good morning.
I have two questions. The first one is, I'm wondering if there's any evidence that chiggers have moved into the state of Wisconsin. And my second question is, I'm curious if there's anywhere a person can send in a deer tick to have it diagnosed to see if it's carrying Lyme's disease.
Sure. Okay. The first thing, chiggers have always been here. You think of chiggers as being more of an issue down south, but there have always been chiggers here. Just ask my wife. She happens to be a chigger magnet. And, you know, typically what chiggers are a type of mite that typically feeds on insects as a predator, and we're the wrong host. And what's frustrating is the chigger burrows into you and often leaves before your body reacts. And, of course, it itches, and it's, you know, a very unpleasant experience. Generally speaking, raspberry patches, I don't know why, but is a kind of environment you often see chiggers. So there's certain areas, but when you run into them, you got to think back. Where have I been the last couple of days to see if you can point to the area that might indeed be a problem. And if you go into those, you know, using the same kind of protection you do against the ticks, spraying pants, you know, tucking your legs, it isn't a bad idea if you get in, you know, again, if you've had a problem in the raspberry patch, when you're done picking the raspberries, jump in the shower and take a good shower and towel off in particular, because what you're doing is removing the mites before they get a chance to burrow into your person. So now the deer tick thing, I don't know anymore. Way back in the day up at Gunderson Clinic in La Crosse, they did. But the argument now with deer ticks is, our adult ticks run at least 40% positive. Our immature ticks run 20% if we're talking about the nymphal stage. And that incident is high enough that if you have a deer tick that's been feeding on you for a couple days in Wisconsin, you should get a single day's treatment of antibiotic from your doctor. No questions asked. Don't wait to test. The problem, if you send it somewhere, it's going to take days to get an answer. And the argument there is that if that tick was carrying it and was feeding on your person, you allow that spirochete or bacteria to spread in your system, versus if you treat it prophylactically, is that you're killing the organism before a chance it gets to go anywhere. And the recommendation from CDC, and this is a number of years ago, is if once it reaches 20% in a state, people should be treated preventatively if you know it's a deer tick. And that's the big question most physicians will ask. Are you sure? I mean, we call them black-legged ticks now officially, but most of us grew up calling them deer ticks. Is if you can send the picture to somebody or bring the tick in, because sometimes physicians will be reluctant to give you the antibiotic unless they know it is a black-legged or deer tick. I've talked to a number of people. In fact, to be honest, I get those pictures every spring from people trying to sort through and trying to give them the information they need to talk to their physician. If you're sending it off, I bet you, I'm sure you can find a lab, but I bet you it's going to cost you $40 or $50 minimum to get. And as I said, I go back to the point, if it was on your person, you know that it was there long enough because of the history we've got in the state, it doesn't matter. You should be treated and just leave it at that.
There you go, Linda. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Linda mentioned raspberries, and Dave in Wausau wonders, what are the little white worms he's seeing on wild raspberries?
Oh, boy, I bet you that is the little fruit fly that we got, the spotted-winged Drosophila, which is, again, I've been retired for 10 years, but it was just hitting the fan when I was leaving. And it lays its eggs in the berries before they even color up. So people that have raspberry patches, when they bring them in, all of a sudden they notice they got these little white maggots, and that was... You know, it's more typical of fruit flies, the typical fruit flies, to lay their eggs when fruit is overly ripe. But this kind of gets it much easier. And if I had to guess, as I said, because that critter is spread throughout the state and has been for quite some time, is that would be it. Is that we call it the spotted-winged Drosophila. Drosophila is just the scientific name for fruit flies. And there are numerous other species, but none that pull this trick.
Thanks. That's a great question. Thanks so much for that. And ticks. We did mention deer ticks. What about wood ticks and other ticks? I mean, they seem to be pretty out there this year.
Yeah, a good number. Milder winter, although I find ticks all the time. We're late enough now that the wood tick numbers have gone down considerably. The bigger concern is we are in that summer stage that the smaller immature wood ticks that we call nymphs are active. And if you correlate when most people get Lyme disease, it's when these smaller ticks are feeding because they're easily overlooked. You know, larger ticks you can often see on your person before they get a chance to make you sick. But these nymphal stages are not. And as I said, I think that's the one thing that changed when growing up before the black-legged or deer ticks took over is the tick season was the spring and early summer, and then we were done. Now the tick season is anytime there's no snow on the ground. And as I said, in particular the summer, you get this false idea because you don't see big ticks crawling on your person that they're not out there, but it's their smaller stages.
Yeah. They're there. Phil Pelletieri will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with Phil. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Taking a look at World of Insects today with Phil Pelletieri, Distinguished Faculty Emeritus at UW-Madison. And at 12:30, we'll talk to Mauriel Rodriguez-Curath about the interplay of wolves and other carnivorous mammals on Lake Superior's Isle Royale. Mauriel did some research on that. I found it really interesting. We'll take a look at that. But in the meantime, we're still talking insects, and if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's take a call from Pilar in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. My question's about powder post beetles.
Okay.
We recently moved some things out of an old building that was infested with powder post beetles. And I have a couple of sort of medium-sized wooden objects that I think are probably affected. I'm wondering, how do I treat them to get rid of the powder post beetle eggs and larvae that might be inside the wood? I've read things about like freezing or using heat, and so I'm wondering.
Sure.
So the objects themselves, are they open vesseled or are they painted, sealed, varnished items?
Yeah, so actually the main object is an old carousel wooden horse head. And so it's got some remnants of paint, but a lot of it is unpainted. And it's got the little exit holes, and we saw enough evidence of like sawdusty stuff that I'm pretty sure that it is.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, that's a typical pattern. The reason I asked is typically anything that is sealed, they need open vessels to lay their eggs into. The other thing that goes on is that over time, in most of our homes where that are heated, our wood gets too dry to be suitable, but that can take quite some time. So in other words, that's why you don't see much in the way of powder post beetles in a normal home, because most of our stuff is painted or varnished or sealed in one form or another, and it's also too dry. But old barn wood and whatnot in unheated buildings is where these things often can thrive. And, yeah, you got three or four ways of tackling it. You don't worry so much about this infestation spreading to other things in the house. You worry about the object and saving it. Freezing is a little tricky in that what kills insects is sharp contrasts. And so typically you can take something in the summer that is warmed up and they're active, throw it in the freezer for 3 or 4 days, take it out. Honestly, I'd let it warm up again for about a week or so, and then do it again just to be on the safe side. And again, hoping that the shock would take them out. The other side on heating, insects cannot survive above 112 degrees. So it's not that you need an excessive amount of heat, but the question is, on a large object, you got to guarantee you get 112 degrees in the center of the object. But if there's anything, you know, that's why kiln drying, honestly, kills powder post beetles in the kiln. But if the wood is not handled properly afterwards, if they can potentially reinfest it, but I'm not worried about that for you. The third option, and this one probably you'd rather not go that way, but it is an option. They do sell, especially at log home supply companies and the like, basically a form of boric acid. It's technically called sodium octaborate. And if you painted that on the unfinished parts of the wood, it soaks in, and then when the beetles come out and feed on it, they die. So, you know, that is suitable for, let's say, a great big fireplace mantle that was unfinished, you know, barn wood you could put on it. But an object like this that really is mostly painted and the like, I'm not sure that would work. And the problem, you know, when you've got a painted surface, honestly, to really work well, you got to take all the paint off so that the borate soak in throughout the piece of wood. And as I said, that's why I don't think that would be. I would just look at your other two options of, as I said, trying the freezing, if you can find a freezer that's big enough, or finding a way that you can heat it, you know, without going to too extreme, realizing that the magic temperature is about 112 degrees.
All right. Good luck with that. It sounds like it's well worth saving, that's for sure. Chris in Bailey's Harbor. Hi, Chris. Chris, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm in Bailey's Harbor, Wisconsin, and wondering about the Lone Star, what potentially diseases those might carry for us.
The Lone Star tick.
So the Lone Star tick is normally a critter that we would equate to states south of us, you know, southern Illinois, Missouri, and the like. Throughout my career, we used to get occasional ticks showing up, and they were hitchhiking on birds, but there was no evidence of them breeding in the state till about 10 or 15 years ago. And my colleague, Susan Paskowitz, who does a lot of work on Lyme disease, and her students found that we were starting to get Lone Star ticks breeding, and now we know that they are breeding in the southern part of the state. Still not overly frequent, but they're there. And the main concern with Lone Star tick is this interesting phenomena that when they feed on certain individuals, the components in their saliva causes the people to become allergic to meat to the point that, I mean, they can get quite sick eating meat. And the original research, honestly, came out in a cancer trial. It's just real crazy how all these pieces fell into place. So that adds a new complication. There are some other diseases they can spread, but honestly, the biggest concern has been this meat allergy problems they've got. Now, you're up far enough north. I know I had records up your way, but I still don't think that they're breeding that far north. As we've seen the southern third of the state kind of go that direction, you could argue it will happen. It just might take, you know, decades to get that far north with your climate being a little bit more tempered. But now the tick gets the name because the males have this very distinct white spot on the back. It's kind of pearly colored on their kind of reddish brown bodies. So they're quite distinctive. But the immature stages don't have that. And as I said, definitely the big thing. And not all people develop this. In fact, a majority of people don't. But those people that do, you can see that is life-changing for them.
Oh, absolutely. Chris, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Rhinelander will give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Yes, kind of similar to what Phil mentioned a little bit ago. We have a cabin in the UP that it's log-sided, and a bear continually chews up the corners of it. And our thought is we can't see any infestation from the outside, but we're wondering if there's some sort of bug or a larvae that the bear may be able to smell or hear that we can't. Is there any...
Boy,
bears go after something like that.
I can't think of anything that would be substantial enough. I mean, again, I can think of critters that get in there, but they're real tiny critters, and why would a bear waste time? You know, I've seen bears get into stumps that you've got great big grubs and other things that are more of a mouthful that would make sense. But I'm at a loss to think of anything that would be substantially size-wise big enough to be worth the bear's effort. And so I wonder if there's some other kind of behavior responsible for why they're picking on it.
Yeah, maybe it's something with the bear itself.
And there you would wonder again if there could be something that could be sprayed that would make the wood distasteful and the like. And whether they're home remedies like hot peppers, but that wouldn't last overly long. But there, we do have things that we put on plants, keep deer and rabbits away. I wonder if there might even be some sealants or other things that would discourage the bear. That might take a little bit of work figuring out what it would be. But as I said, I just think it's a strange behavior on the bear, and there should be some way of convincing it to stop.
Okay, Tom, thank you for calling. Tina in Black River Falls, we'll go to you next. Hi, Tina.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about June bugs. I'd say about 4 or 5 years ago, we live out in the country. We had June bugs all the time. And then 1 year, boom, we didn't have any. And we've not had them since.
What's up?
So it turns out what we typically call June bugs are a type of beetle, and there are, 25, 30 different species at least in the state. And they have 1 to 2 year life cycles. And, typically they arrive in May and June. And you do get these years where the populations are high, where there's just adults everywhere, and then the conditions are such that they just don't do as well. So I would lean more to that. Although saying that, I will tell you, there was a whole lot more June beetles out there when I was young than I see nowadays. In fact, again, being a young entomologist, I'd go out and collect as many different kinds as I could, and you'd see them at street lights and whatnot. And boy, I just don't see them anymore, which is a kind of this general phenomenon with insect populations of really having dramatic changes. But in your case, as I said, I would wonder this phenomena, and it's interesting, they will cause lawn damage. There will be enough grubs in your lawn that you get skunks and other things tearing your lawns up in the fall to get after the grubs in these bad years. And you always correlate the spring that you have the big adult populations, that's when you get the big grub populations, that fall and the next spring that we have all this wildlife damage associated with. And again, it's been my experience is you get an outbreak of that, and it might be 15 years before you see it again in your own backyard.
Yeah, and Dave in Madison, to kind of go along with this, Dave is a fly fisherman. Curious whether it's true there are fewer mayflies and caddisflies than in the past.
It's water quality related. I had the pleasure of taking a course from Bill Hilsenhoff when I was a student, and Bill was one of the first people that got into stream quality. He did a survey of all the aquatic insects in the state. But what he found is as the stream conditions change, whether you get more oxygen, less oxygen, more organic matter and the like, that affected populations. And generally the kind of stream quality you need for trout is on the high end. And usually when things start to disappear, it's because, again, the water quality is going downhill. And if you start losing those insects, that affects the fish population. So it's not a good direction to see. And now, that being said, there are water conditions we've seen have improved. One of the interesting sidelights I had seen is black flies, which also breed in streams. They tend to thrive under the cleaner water that we've gotten in some cases with various stream bank improvements and other things that we do that improve the environment. But there are some critters, unfortunately, we wish wouldn't take advantage of it, and black flies are one of them. So, yeah, I would agree that caddisflies and mayflies – but basically it has to do, again, with water temperature, oxygen levels, organic matter, all those things that we would look at to define stream quality usually going the wrong direction.
Let's go to Ron in La Crosse then. Ron, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I bought something from a garden store. It's called diatomaceous earth, and it supposedly keeps crawling insects like ants and things from coming into your house. Put along a threshold, maybe use some carpet tape, which is adhesive on both sides, and sprinkle some of it on that. So I think that way you don't have to use any toxic chemicals or sprays. You wouldn't want to use those in the kitchen anyway.
No.
Yeah, so diatomaceous earth, if you can find any insect in a jar with diatomaceous earth, it will die. And it's interesting, in some climates, they literally will blow diatomaceous earth, or there's a silica aerogel is a synthetic version of the same thing, into walls to, quote, insect-proof a house. It's got its potential uses. We don't do that. Now, part of it is because we don't have that kind of insect pressure. So, yes, if you know where they're coming from and you can force them to go through it, but in some environments, if it blows away or it gets washed or whatnot, it will not have the effect because it's basically an abrasive. It's like sandpaper to the insects. And when it scrubs their body, it causes them to dry out and desiccate. And so if you understand that, you can see where its uses would be work, or, again, where the places where things can weather, get washed away, blown away or whatnot, they're not near as effective.
Ron, thank you very much for calling. George in Platteville, let's go to you now. Hi, George.
Yes, I heard you mention that there were a lot fewer June beetles that you were seeing, and I've kind of noticed that there are a lot fewer bugs in general. I'm not seeing bees. I'm not seeing a whole lot of wasps like we used to. And I was wondering if you thought that there was any correlation between that and the chemtrails that we're seeing in the atmosphere. I know they're spraying a lot of silica and other aluminum oxides and stuff, trying to do this geoengineering stuff. And I was wondering if that you thought that that was having an effect on the insect population.
Yeah, so this trend of insect population decline has been documented worldwide for decades now. And again, a lot of it, I'm familiar with some research out of Germany in some forested situations where they tracked the insects in the 1970s versus now, and you see this decline in Puerto Rico, you name it. And as they've looked at it, it really is a wide array of things. You know, climate change in particular. In some cases, there are some pesticide issues. I don't know of anybody who has pointed to chemtrails as far as being an issue. And as I said, some of this has been going on long enough. And in places where, it's quite concerning because it's been in enough different environments where there's lots of people, not lots of people, you name it, that it really isn't quite clear. And as I said, as people have tried to dissect it, they can prove that it has a number of causes, but there's not just one thing you can put your finger on that's resulting in the thing. But we've all witnessed it. I mean, part of it's because of the change in the kind of street lighting we have. But as a kid, I remember the clouds of critters around street lights, and you do not see that anymore. I have not seen that in a very long time.
Yeah, unfortunately. Thank you very much for calling on that comment. Dale from Douglas County recommends putting a loop of fly tape on your hat to kind of catch those insects that want to be buzzing around your head.
Yeah, that there is, in fact, a commercial version of that. It was a tread knot deer fly trap, which was just a sticky 3x5 card kind of that you put on your hat in the same thing. So if you got something that's sticky because they are attracted to the head, they land on the hat in that sticky area, you got them. So if you can come with a home version of that, yes, it definitely helps reduce the numbers.
And Michael in Madison emailed to say they've flowering perennials that previously attracted dozens of bumblebees, and so far this year they've seen no bumblebees and wondering why.
Boy, it depends. I was pleasantly surprised to find a bumblebee nest, unfortunately when I was mowing, but they didn't do anything. They just got kind of roused in my wall. Because bumblebees nest in the ground, if I had to guess if their numbers were hurting, I wonder about flooding in the spring. Because being in the ground with all that water seeping in, that's got to be tough on them. And so, as I said, I'm sure there are some other people that are monitoring bumblebee populations in general that might have a more definitive answer. But my thing in such wet springs, I would think that a lot of the early nests, because they start in the spring from queens that are finding holes in the ground to start their nests. And as I said, with these weather conditions, I can see that that's not going to be so good for a lot of them.
Ellie in Madison, this goes back to something we talked about earlier. She shared that she had a nymphal deer tick embedded under her watch band after going berry picking. She said she got a prescription for doxycycline, and they sent the tick to Marshfield Clinic. The clinic said they were not testing for patients anymore. They were. But they're not anymore, but they are accepting submissions for tick research.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, and again, I remember seeing that Marshfield was involved with, because, you know, the one thing that I have seen in my career is the continued expansion of lists of tick-borne diseases that are transmitted to people. You know, and a lot of these are wildlife diseases that are transmitted, and, you know, again, deer tick was not officially it was recognized when I was in an undergrad, but we didn't quite know or have any idea of all the different diseases, the anaplasmosis, the ehrlichiosis, tick-borne fevers. I mean, it's just mind-boggling the increase in a number of human diseases that we've seen, and that's why research like they're doing up in Marshfield, both to monitor what we got, but to see if there's anything new things coming up. So that's neat. I'm glad they shared that with us.
Yeah. Susan in Washburn has a quick question, I believe. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Hi, thanks. I'm Susan, and I live in Washburn. I live outside of town on a lot of sandy soil. There are a lot of ants on my patio, ant hills that are there every summer. They get into my house. They go around the edge of my house, and they build back really fast. I tried using boiling water, and it seems to work temporarily because I'm trying not to hurt my animals or me with repellent.
Yeah.
So, and the frustration with ground nesting ants is that the queen is so deep in the ground and you can't get her, and not with boiling water, is my experience. And so this does fall into that arena of if you're willing to use pesticides, and you can use something natural like pyrethrin, although typically, because it doesn't last that long, I would look at it, maybe some other alternatives. But the way to get after them, you can take a rake and rake off some of the soil, take a rod or something similar, and push it down into the ant nest as far as you reasonably can go, at least 6-8 inches and farther if you can. Mix up whatever your product of choice is. Again, whether it's an insecticide like pyrethrum, which comes from chrysanthemums, or some other garden insecticide, dilute it at the normal level, but you pour it into that hole so that it soaks deep. But then you cap it with that untreated soil. So it's basically you're protecting things above ground from it, and it's getting down to where it would do the most good. So that would be what I would suggest. Now, you can consider trying the boiling water, but I would still do the same trick of putting some channels to get that down as deep as you can. And honestly, the pyrethrum might not work a whole lot different than the boiling water because it breaks down so quickly. In the boiling water, it's the same thing. If the hot temperature gets to the queen, she's dead. If it doesn't, 5 minutes later, it's like you didn't do anything.
So, and channels, more than one, you're saying?
Yeah, typically I'll do 3 or 4 and the like. And as I said, as long as the product's registered for use outdoors on plants or similar things, ants are not hard to kill. It's just getting the product where it will do the most good. And as I said, I've always liked these treatments, both because they work, but secondly, because I can do it in a manner that I don't put a bunch of stuff on the surface. And you can cap it and basically protect other things from it. And the kind of pesticides we use nowadays break down relatively quickly in the soil. It's not like the old days where we had stuff you'd put there that would be there for months at end. The stuff doesn't work that way anymore. Within a few days, honestly, most of that stuff would be dissipated and degraded.
Phil, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, emeritus professor in the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. He was in charge of the insect diagnostic lab for a long time. Coming up, we're going to take a look at some research on wolves and other animals on Isle Royal in Lake Superior. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, the longest predator-prey research study in the world is focused on wolves and moose on Isle Royal in Lake Superior. For 65 years, researchers have tracked the moose and wolf populations on that remote island. And there's now a new study that looks at how additional wolves released there in 2018 have impacted the other smaller carnivores, including red fox and American martens. Larry Mueller here. Joining us today, Muriel Rodriguez-Coraz, who is the lead author of the latest study, part of his PhD dissertation as a grad student, working with Professor Jonathan Pauley in UW-Madison Forest and Wildlife Ecology Program in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. So as we talk with Muriel, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the the much-studied wolves on Isle Royale. Do you wonder about the role they played in the ecosystem? Have you visited Isle Royale? We'll talk about Mario's research, of course. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Mario, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, Larry. It's really nice to be here.
Let's talk. You know, this is the longest predator-prey study in the world. In all those years, have we learned a lot about wolves and the balance of nature and moose and the other predators?
I think we have. I think it'll be, you know, really nice to kind of provide a little bit of backdrop for some of the species on Isle Royale and just how much it has changed over the last couple hundred years. So in the early 1900s, there were no wolves or moose on Isle Royale. And that might be, you know, surprising to some people, but the island was kind of predominantly habited by caribou and lynx. And it wasn't until the early 1900s that moose made it onto the island, and then until the late 1940s when wolves made it. And there was this really long period of time when moose were out on the island, out by themselves. And what researchers really started seeing then is that their populations were drastically increasing well beyond their carrying capacity, the number of animals that the island could sustain. And then that population crashed. And it wasn't until wolves made it onto the island that we started seeing this kind of balance between their predators and prey that we classically see. A lot of the research that started taking place after wolves made it onto the island and Duard Allen started doing research out there was really kind of followed or it was in following the studies that people like Aldo Leopold were doing, looking at predator-prey relationships and some of the studies that Bob Payne in Washington was doing with starfish, looking at the relationships also of predators and prey and how these larger carnivores or top predators in an ecosystem can kind of regulate their prey. And then that has some potential beneficial impacts for the entire ecosystem.
How did you come to study the impact of wolves on other carnivores on Isle Royale?
Yeah, my history of studying carnivores, kind of, which is not very long, but goes back to being really fortunate in my undergrad and having really good colleagues and mentors and friends that kind of turned me on to some research that was going on in Argentina. Also predators and prey, where my co-advisor throughout my master's then was looking at the impacts of pumas on vicuñas. And I went out there and helped out with some field work, told them that I was really interested in doing a master's or a PhD. And he got me in touch with Dr. Jonathan Pauly. And we started talking about a couple of different ideas. And I eventually did my master's in Argentina, in Patagonia, looking at the impacts of pumas or mountain lions on these two species of foxes. And my co-advisor had focused throughout his PhD on looking at carnivore interactions, and so it just kind of naturally followed. But my work in Isle Royale was kind of all through serendipity, I think.
I know how that works.
Yeah. I had read about these studies in my undergrad, and it was, you know, it was amazing. I always wanted to visit and to see what it was like. And I was starting my PhD during 2020, in the middle of the pandemic, and my plans were to still go back to Patagonia, to Argentina, and continue studying pumas and other foxes, carnivores down there. And travel was shut down, you know. Couldn't get down there for several years. And John had started this project well before I started my PhD, starting to really focus on martens in Isle Royale and kind of looking at their colonization history, how they made it onto the island. And then he suggested that maybe I shift a little bit for my PhD from looking at these pumas and mountain lions in these human systems where predominantly it was a lot of ranching. And so I was thinking about conflict a lot and shifting to wolves, another large carnivore, but in a place that we don't necessarily think of as being really human dominated and having a lot of human impact. So it really was serendipity.
Yeah, I get it's pretty cool. I love how that all worked out for you. Well, the research on this, this kind of research, you don't sit back in the office and ponder.
No.
You
got to
get out there. Talk about your research.
Yeah, so the fieldwork component is we go out a couple of times out of the year. We go out during summer and during winter. And all of the research that that I guess we'll be talking about was really during the summer efforts. We go out for a couple of months during summer, hike around, hike the trails on Isle Royale, which has a pretty nice and extensive trail system. And we collect samples that we then send off to genetics so that we can get individual identity. We can confirm the species that we're seeing on the trails. And we basically rinse and repeat that process many, many times. We hike about 750 kilometers each year. And fortunately, we have a nice bunkhouse that we can go back to and rest our feet.
And you're extracting, I mean, you're collecting samples, you're extracting DNA, analyzing tissues from those samples. So here we had in 2018, we had 19 wolves relocated to Isle Royale. And your study looked at how the introduction of those wolves affected the small carnivores, like the red foxes and other carnivores. What did you learn?
Yeah, I think there's two major punchlines that we learned. And but first, we were kind of expecting these within carnivores. What we generally see across the globe is these interactions or species interactions, either behavioral or changes in their abundances, that are driven by their body size difference. So the difference in larger species and the smaller species, where generally the larger species will tend to bully or push around or even kill the smaller species. And so what we were expecting to see after this wolf reintroduction is that wolves would, to some effect, suppress red foxes, and that in turn would create a positive impact for the martens out there. And we did detect that interaction, but we were really keen on looking at the different phases of the wolf reintroduction. So we had the fortunate foresight of my advisor to kind of collect some data before all of this happened. So before the wolf reintroduction, which we used kind of as a baseline, the first year after the wolf reintroduction, which we really considered a period of establishment. This wolf population was barely establishing on the island, 19 individuals. They were moving around a lot more than they used to, trying to really establish their hierarchy within their social packs and ultimately their home ranges. And then in the third year, which is when we think that the real functional return of wolves occurred in Isle Royale, the wolves started breeding. They were really taking down moose, and they had these two established home ranges, one on the eastern end of the island, one on the western. And so throughout these different phases, we wanted to ask the question of how these impacts the wolf reintroduction would impact the smaller species. And initially what we saw was a really strong and drastic effect to red fox behavior and changes in their diet. And that allowed the martin population to increase in their abundances and also distribute a little bit more widely on the island. But then, kind of shockingly, what we saw is after the wolf packs established and the packs coalesce, that those interactions really return back to their baseline level as if wolves had never been there in the first place.
Huh.
And so, yeah, so our the title of our paper is a pulsed effect. So what we really see is this really strong, drastic effect initially, and then it just kind of subsides. And then another point that was really shocking is Isle Royale is one of the least visited national parks in the U.S. Sees maybe 18 to 22,000 visitors a year. And we saw a really strong impact of human activity on the island, particularly to red foxes. Red foxes are really curious. They're really successful everywhere that they inhabit. And they're really variable in their behavior. And one of the things that they do is they interact with humans quite a bit. And we think that this impact of humans onto red foxes kind of allowed them to kind of buffer some of the more dramatic impacts that we might have seen from wolves.
Really interesting. Mario Rodriguez Curas, our guest today, he is the lead author of a study of how small carnivores have been impacted by reintroduced wolves on Lake Superior's Isle Royale. Questions for him about wolves, about Isle Royale? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a note that tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll be talking about vehicle maintenance. My old friend Jim Ward, retired service manager from Smart Motors Toyota, will be our guest tomorrow. But right now, we're taking a look at a study done on Lake Superior's Isle Royale, and the person and lead author of the study we're talking about, Muriel Rodriguez Coraz, is with us right now. Questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Just a sidelight question that doesn't relate to your research necessarily, but I was reading somewhere where ravens, the birds, are at least part of the reason why wolves run in packs. Is that really true?
I have not. Maybe I'll be completely honest. I have not seen this, but I have heard that there's a very, very interesting and really exciting association between ravens and wolves. That ravens will kind of follow along wolf prey, and they'll start making calls, and those sounds kind of draw in wolves to where their prey might be. But I had not heard that. That's why they run in packs, but.
I thought if you were a lone wolf and if you killed a large animal, that the ravens are going to get a lot of it. And if you're in packs, that sort of makes sense to me. But it was just a statement without a reasoning behind it. Got me wondering. I just wondered.
No, that's a really interesting observation, and I can absolutely see some of the benefits of having a larger pack to kind of consume the prey. So the research that I've seen on kind of these obligate scavengers like vultures or condors,
yeah,
things like that, is that they can really alter how much food is left in a carcass, because wolves will make the kill. They'll eat a lot of food. Sometimes they'll gorge themselves for 20 pounds or so of meat, and then they'll just go lay down. And that's an opportunity for all these vultures and other scavengers to come in, and they'll really start picking at the carcass. And some of the estimates are that vultures and other scavengers can really increase the kill rates of wolves just because of how much pressure they put on these kills. So it does make sense for larger packs to form.
Mike in Coon Valley has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I know you're dealing with the carnivore side of it more than this, but I'm just wondering if any of the studies done on the interaction between the wolves and the moose can be put to use in the trouble with the deer herd and the wolves in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the research that has taken place on wolves and moose in Isle Royal would definitely apply to their other potential prey. I'd say moose and deer are pretty different. I think a moose is maybe three times, if not more, the size of a deer. And so on a place where wolves, their primary prey is moose, they don't need to make as many kills as they would in a place where it's deer. And we do have I'm not in Wisconsin anymore, but there is a pretty healthy wolf population there that has been subject to a lot of, you know, public scrutiny, and there's been a lot of debates about it. But the things that I have seen from wolves and moose in Isle Royal is really this balance that kind of generally forms, and the populations kind of cycle, so they oscillate every 20 or so years, where the moose will really increase in abundances, and then that population will crash, but it never goes down to zero, and there's always this kind of balance that occurs in more natural prey systems. So could definitely see it applying to, you know, deer and wolf.
In Wisconsin, yeah. Mike, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that call. So the presence of wolves did change the diets, right? Of foxes and martens?
Go ahead. So primarily foxes. What we saw before and after this wolf reintroduction, that marten diet didn't really change so much. So martens are what we consider to be, they're somewhat specialized on smaller mammals and birds. And they're really, they really position themselves in areas of really high forest complexity. Lots of coarse wooded debris on the ground, just lots of complexity, really. And they use those forests to their advantage so that they can seek out their prey. And those relationships in diet for martens didn't really change. But really interestingly, what we saw is that foxes shifted their diets, and they really developed these two foraging strategies where some individuals really cued in on moose, on carrion from wolves, and others focused in on human foods, these individuals that were really coming into these campsites and somehow acquiring our food, human food. And what we have tried to kind of unpack following this research is what those true different strategies, what they really mean for foxes. When these are two foods that are kind of subsidies, so there's a larger species that's kind of providing some sort of food resource for the foxes, but the risk associated with those two resources is really different. Wolves will hunt down, or they'll chase down and potentially hurt foxes, whereas humans generally tend not to do. If anything, we just pull out our phones and take some pictures. So the risk associated with those two strategies is really what we're looking into right now.
That's really fascinating to me that what's telling me is that they're adaptable in some
Absolutely.
Ways.
They are.
And there could be some genetic thing that would involve, or maybe could it be just circumstance, location of the animals?
Yeah, they really are adaptable. One thing that I learned last year, started digging into, is that I think foxes are, they inhabit, have the most diversity in the places they inhabit. They do just as well in arid landscapes in the Middle East, and they're also in the largest cities in the world, like in London, in people's backyards. And
we have them in our backyards in Madison. I know that.
Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely, in Madison. And I think there's really exciting research just starting to kind of come about into what those genetic differences are of foxes that live in cities and those that live outside of cities.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Just to, I know we're kind of running out of time here, but
no,
this
we got
is really
time.
Exciting.
Yeah.
The one really interesting thing that I've seen recently is that the shape of the fox snout changes kind of drastically in areas that are more inhabited by. In cities, really, this was work done out in England in the UK, where researchers collected fox skulls within the city of London, and then some skulls that were outside of the city, well outside of the city, and more of a wild population. And what they see is that their muzzles kind of decrease in size. They're not as pointy. They kind of like become a little bit more rounded and a little bit shorter. And
when they're in the city.
When they're in the city, yeah. Oh. Yeah, and there's a lot of, there's this this captive population of foxes out in Russia that's been an ongoing experiment for the last 60 years, I want to say 70 years. And they've really habituated some of these foxes to people, and they've started tracking down genetically what those changes are. And we also get, you know, a shorter snout, we get their ears starting to droop, their coats begin to change color. They become a lot more like dogs.
Dogs, and, I was going to say.
Yeah. And really quickly, I think the some of those first results were coming out that within 40 years, about maybe 25 to 30 generations of foxes, we start seeing these really drastic habituation.
That's really fascinating to me. Back to Isle Royale, though, for a minute. What happens to those? Let me put it this way. I'm assuming that most of the people come in the summer to Isle Royale. And so those who are habituated to people, what do they do in the wintertime?
Yeah, absolutely. I wish I could share a photo with all of the viewers. We had this, so as I mentioned earlier, we're doing research during the summer and the winter, and this becomes what we kind of call an ecological trap, where some individuals become really habituated to a certain food source, which is, you know, people food, and then during winter, when there are no humans on the island, they're either they tend to not do as well, The picture that I have is this fox that's very habituated. Everyone knows her by her name, Scrappy. And she's out at the cabins where we stay during winter. And she's out by the dumpsters kind of checking for food. But we do a really good job of keeping these, you know, these are really like bear safe dumpsters. And,
yeah. So she has a lot of trouble in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah. We think so, but she's also, I think at this point, we've been kind of following her. I think at this point, she's had two litters of kits, and so she is surviving. She's doing well, even with her, she has an eye that's kind of, she's blind in one eye, but yeah, she's doing really well.
Well, this is fascinating work, Muriel, that you're doing. I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about it. It was really interesting, and I hope we get a chance to do it again. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I would love to. Thanks, Larry. It was really great to be here.
Muriel Rodriguez-Coras, our guest today, and it was great talking with him about his UW research. Great to have you with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll also be talking about a women's motorcycle group called Madison Litas, which is making a space. Thanks so much for listening. A big thanks to our whole team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our technical director, Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, and I'm Larry Mueller.